And letting go ain't easy, a crazy part of life in a sense. When I lost my granny, I was down to a cent. Money wasn't coming, I was low on my rent. Sleeping on the couch and I would never forget when I was stressing over a blessing and contemplating my purpose, the music in my direction. Fading my every word, a surprise and I'm on a rise. And I made it over the top, it's wavy, a long journey. But that's a part of the ride when you're learning to get your heart or something. You start treating every moment like it's all or nothing. But no doubts when you're down, think it's all with nothing. We all we got, so all we give is 100. Never run it, never run it. Counting me out, but now I'm in a discussion with the greatest of the great. And ironic the way the trailblazers, we ain't showing love to the haters, and they got stale faces. Never stressing any blessing, give it up to God, give it up to God. That's why I pray and maintaining my position.
Hey, you've been listening to Rose City Hip Hop Radio Special. This is KBOO Portland. We've got Bread and Roses coming right up for you, and after that is Hard Knock Radio.
Please join us on Saturday, March 25th for an Archives Database Edit-a-thon and party. This event will run from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We are recruiting current and past KBOO volunteers and listeners who hold knowledge of KBOO's 49-year history, and we are recruiting archivists, librarians, and any other person that enjoys information seeking and data entry to document this collective knowledge. This event is free and open to the public, but we need you to register so we can plan for the event. Find out more by emailing archive@kboo.fm or online at kboo.fm/editparty2017.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Identities and Futures. Women and non-binary folks speak out March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene in Portland. Identities and Futures is an evening of performances, animation, and DJs, including DJ Kim Fizzy, Lily Croft, Gene Etheridge, Pocha Radicales, and more. Again, that's Identities and Futures, Women and Non-Binary Folks Speak Out, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Donald Trump just gave his first address to a joint session of Congress. On today's show, we'll dissect his speech, his contradictions, and the things that were left unsaid with my guest, Richard Eskow. He's a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. And we'll go to London to speak with a preeminent British historian of the Third Reich. Sir Richard J. Evans has written many books about Hitler's rise to power, and he'll join me to compare Trump's agenda with what emerged in Germany historically. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Donald Trump gave his first address to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday night, sounding more scripted and grammatically correct than he has done in a long time. He began by warning lawmakers that he would be delivering, quote, a message of unity and strength. only to trot out family members of those killed by undocumented immigrants as a way to justify his crackdown on all immigrants. Trump boasted about calling for, quote, one of the largest increases in national defense spending in American history, and then went on to assert that America is better off when there is less conflict, not more, and that, quote, war and the destruction have ravaged and raged throughout the world. He made no mention of Social Security and Medicare, but did denounce the, quote, imploding Obamacare disaster. Some critics offered praise, saying that for the first time, Trump appeared presidential. But beyond the style, did the substance of his vision remain as dangerous as it has been? My guest is Richard Askow. He is the host of The Zero Hour, a weekly radio program, and a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. He's a former consultant and public policy advisor, and his writings have appeared in a number of print and digital publications. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Great to be here, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
So first, let's review for our audience with some of the highlights of the speech that Trump gave on Wednesday night. Here is a series of excerpts put together by CNN from the speech.
While we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil. I am here tonight to deliver a message of unity and strength, and it is a message deeply delivered from my heart. A new national pride is sweeping across our nation, and a new surge of optimism is placing impossible dreams firmly within our grasp. We are also taking strong measures to protect our nation from radical Islamic terrorism. So I am calling on all Democrats and Republicans in Congress to work with us to save Americans from this imploding Obamacare disaster. We will soon begin the construction of a great, great wall along our southern border. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless the United States.
And that's Donald Trump on Wednesday night, giving his first address to a joint session of Congress. In future years, it'll be simply called the State of the Union Address. But the first time a president gives such an address, it's simply called an address to the joint session of Congress because he hasn't had a chance to preside over much of a state yet. So my guest, Richard Askow, joins me now to discuss what took place Wednesday night. First of all, let's get the issue of style out of the way before we get into substance. Yes, certainly. Trump seems to have finally hired a speechwriter. Should we be making a big deal of that?
No, I don't think so. Look, I mean, he set the bar so low with his campaign and then with his inaugural speech that I think a lot of the media were thrilled and grateful that he didn't declare the end of days and call down hellfire on the world's enemies. You know, the fact is that this was almost this from a presidential looking standpoint, this was almost like a trick-or-treating child. He looked like a president the way a trick-or-treater looks like a cowboy or Princess Leia, you know. But the bar has been set so low. He is so unpopular compared to previous presidents. He's done so badly in terms of acceptability to the media in previous speeches that they were just thrilled that he pretended to be points at uplifting at points. And of course, as we heard in that clip, we know he was uplifting because he told us so. He said, oh, I'm going to speak to you wonderful words from the heart or whatever he said. The fact is, this was not a great speech. It was not a presidential speech in the term that, you know, historically we think of it. And on substance, it was the same old Trump and the same old Republicanism.
Right. I mean, if we actually judged him by the standards that previous presidents are judged by, it might be completely different. So, yes, he said he opened up saying that he was going to deliver a message of unity and strength. He denounced, you know, the issues of division. And you know, if anything, his campaign and his short presidential tenure have been all about division. He said, we must not drive the wedge of disunity. And it's really, it's what it is, division. It's unadulterated division. That in that case, he was talking about critiques of law enforcement and police officers. But then, of course, his speech focused on, as we just heard, building a great, beautiful wall. What is a wall except for division?
Right. What is a special unit with the dystopian name Voice, which he also promised in this speech to provide, that singles out the victims of immigrant crimes, even though immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than other people in this country? What is that if not sowing division and fear and all those things? Look, the press and other people are acting grateful because he said it's bad to desecrate cemeteries based on the religions of the deceased. You know, that's how low the standard has gotten.
Right. Right. The office that you mentioned, Voice, stands for Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement. And studies have shown time and again that immigrants in this country commit fewer crimes per capita than native-born citizens. And that even sanctuary cities are safer than those that are not sanctuary cities. Let's talk about the fact that he did bring up the Kansas shooting. We had covered this horrific story last week when an Indian engineer who had been working in the U.S. on a work visa as a tech worker was shot by white Navy veteran, 51-year-old white man, saying, get out of my country. And Trump, for the first time, finally mentioned it. All he said was, recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City, remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we're a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms. Isn't he the one sowing the division?
Well, of course he is. And he immediately went on to terrify people about all the horrible things immigrants are going to do, which is going to inevitably lead to more crimes of this kind. And, you know, it's striking to me. This is a guy who made a big deal of the fact that President Obama wouldn't use the phrase radical Islamic terrorism. Mm. And yet this is a guy who won't say extremist white terrorism. This is a guy who won't say extremist white nationalist murders, which is what happened in Kansas City last week. He just called it a shooting. So, you know, this is a guy who's really talking out of both sides of his mouth, and people ought to stop congratulating him for it.
Let's talk about the critique of Obamacare. Now, Trump campaigned on repealing Obamacare. His party made it their sole purpose, you know, for existence over the last eight or so years to undermine Obamacare. And then when push came to shove, the party and him realized healthcare might be a little bit more complicated than we imagined, but he has not backed off. Initially, we had heard reports saying that Trump would wait until next year to repeal and replace Obamacare, as he has said. What did you make of what he said on Wednesday night about Obamacare?
Well, you know, it's interesting because Trump, the maverick, supposedly, who broke with the Republican Party on certain issues, and healthcare was one of them, you know, every American should be able to get healthcare and all that. He's now talking like a standard corporate bought and paid for Republican. He's saying, he used the word access, that every American has access to healthcare. Well, as Bernie Sanders said, and I was Bernie's writer in the campaign, but as Bernie said, you know, we all have access to a yacht. We just can't afford it. The fact, you know, but that's a very calculated word. He hired a guy for Health and Human Services, Tom Price, who wants to eliminate Medicare and doesn't care if healthcare is available to all Americans. It won't be. He's using the language of Republicans who want to not only destroy Obamacare, but want to destroy Medicare and certainly don't want Medicare for all.
And we should also remember Democrats loved to use that term access to healthcare as well, you know, universal coverage rather than the right to healthcare. You know, there's a difference between insurance and actually getting healthcare. There's a difference between access to healthcare and being able to afford healthcare. And all of these sort of interesting rhetorical flourishes obscure the fact that healthcare is a human right. Now, he faces a conundrum in that A majority of his supporters rely on the Affordable Care Act. In their mind, the Affordable Care Act is different from Obamacare, but we've seen that red states that voted overwhelmingly for Trump have taken a lot of the greatest advantage of the Affordable Care Act. So how is he going to manage this balancing act?
Well, I guess the answer is very carefully. He's going to have to he's very interested. He's in the camp now with Mike Pence and Tom Price as Health and Human Services Secretary, and Paul Ryan, who's also got voodoo, crazy, I shouldn't use that word, but crazy, superstitious ideas about how the economy works. He's in with those guys. He is, so now he's the sales guy. That's the best way, I think, to look at Trump and the rest of the Republicans. He's a sales guy who tries to make it look like, no, it'll be okay. You'll have health care. You'll have Social Security. But behind the scenes, he's going to be working to destroy those things. And I don't think his goals at this point are any different than theirs are. And I think he was telegraphing that last night between the lines.
Let's talk about the Democrats, because it's very important, of course, that the critique of Trump be accompanied by a critique of the Democrats. The biggest reason that he is in office today is because the Democrats failed to offer a competing vision. Nancy Pelosi got into a spat with Trump ahead of the congressional address. He basically critiqued the Democratic Party, saying it's failed. He said, I like the idea of a two-party system, but we might as well, start moving towards a one-party system because the Democrats have failed so badly. And, in a way, he's right. The Democrats have failed. And it seems as though Nancy Pelosi's only response in the most, public way was to show up wearing all white and encourage other women in the room to wear all white to bring up women's rights and images of the suffragettes. What did you make of that?
Well, I think that, we all agree that the politics of identity is critically important, but there's a faction in the Democratic Party. And by the way, it's inseparable from economic justice, which is, and the Democrats, first of all, they've always trailed on issues of equality. They were late to acknowledge marriage equality. They've been late. They haven't done nearly enough about gender inequalities. They certainly haven't done enough about mass incarceration and the Clinton administration's role in that and all of those things. But they always bring that up when economic issues are on the table. It's almost as if they want to change the subject. And to me, the flaw in the Democratic Party approach was exemplified by the fact that they had the response to Trump given by Steve Beshear, who is a former governor of Kentucky, Democrat, who immediately started off, first of all, said nothing about equality on race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, or anything else, ethnicity. But he also began by the policy portion of his talk by bragging that, quote, he had been fiscally responsible, had balanced our budget and turned deficits into surpluses without raising taxes. Look, people across this country and across all lines of identity are hurting economically right now. They don't care about balancing a budget. And they shouldn't care about balancing a budget because that's process stuff. Democrats or somebody ought to be talking to the American people about jobs, about wages, about an economy that works for everyone. And instead, they're still stuck in this world where they're using symbolism and they're talking about process as if anybody cares or as if in the real world economy it even mattered.
In fact, wasn't that a major Republican talking point about balancing the budget? And, this was something that the Republicans were obsessed with, and progressives were pointing out that a government deficit, if it's going to actually go towards helping people, will in the end stimulate the economy. We shouldn't worry as much about a deficit.
Right, absolutely. And, we issue our own currency. On the Bernie campaign, our economists did a great job on that in researching that issue. The fact is that it's not what we need to be worried about at all. And by the way, the government can borrow money at incredibly low prices right now, virtually being paid to borrow money. Now, that may change under Trump, but the fact is that's not what we need to be worried about now. We need to grow the economy. We need to prime the pump, and we need to rescue millions of human beings, millions upon millions of human beings who are suffering. That's what Democrats should be talking about. Instead, they're still focused on this process stuff. No wonder people, Democratic voters stay home, Republican voters vote for people like Trump. No wonder, because they're not being given an alternative vision of what this country could be if we were willing to make it something different.
Now, on the issue of jobs, which, of course, most Americans are most worried about, rightly so, what did Trump say in his congressional address about infrastructure building, you know, which would be a wonderful way to fix, the failing infrastructure in the country and create jobs for Americans?
Well, you know, Trump during the campaign promised $1 trillion in infrastructure spending, which was the Bernie Sanders number. And it was, as opposed to, you know, Clinton's, which was, I think, a quarter of that amount. And it's more than we got after the 2008 crisis. Now, all of a sudden, what he said last night was $1 trillion investment in the infrastructure of the United States, financed through public and private capital. You see, with these guys, you got to read the fine print. There is the fine print. What he's really saying is, we're going to issue bonds. We're going to create a bonanza for Wall Street. We're going to privatize and sell off the people's resources, like bridges and dams and the federal highway system, that we're going to sell that all off to the private sector so that they can overcharge you to use what was previously free. We've seen this fail in a number of states already. And Wall Street's going to make billions of dollars on it. It's going to be a big giveaway to corporations of Wall Street. That's
so instead of having a government program like we did see under Obama, infrastructure building, maybe to not as great an extent as we needed, Trump is basically going to, we might have to cross the Wells Fargo Bridge and pay a dollar every time we use it, and the workers. Right. Who work on that bridge, won't have the right to a union and won't get paid as well, won't be paid for overtime. I mean, that's the vision, right?
Sure it is. And I mean, Chicago, where they privatized their parking meters, and when the mayor tried to say it's a holiday, let's have alternate side of the street parking and park for free, the company said, no, you can't do that. They actually gave away their sovereign authority as a city. That's what we're seeing. That's what we'll see under Trump. Wow. And by the way, Obama's stimulus program was extremely tepid. It was far less than was needed. And a lot of it, what we really need is what Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, did in the 1950s in building the federal highway system, what FDR did in the 1930s. And he's not going to do that.
One of the other things that Trump did during his speech, which according to Van Jones made him seem extremely presidential, was to bring up the death of a Navy SEAL that happened in Yemen literally days into Trump's presidency, when over dinner Trump approved a plan for a ground attack, a raid that had been planned under Obama and ended up killing dozens of ordinary Yemeni civilians, including children, including an 8-year-old U.S. civilian, U.S. citizen girl. But it also, of course, most importantly, from an American perspective, and I put that in quotes, a U.S. Military person was killed. Now, this young man's widow was at the, was there as a guest, which basically means was there as a prop for Trump.
Right.
But the dead man's father has blamed Trump. Trump blames the military. What was this all about? It was just sort of glossed over by the media.
Well, it wasn't just glossed over by the media. It was praised by the media. You know, it's the most breathtakingly cynical. First of all, Democrats don't have a strong position to condemn him on this, because Obama authorized hundreds and hundreds of these raids, these drone attacks and other extrajudicial killings of American citizens and everything else. So they don't deserve praise on this issue. But the idea that, look, I grieve for the widow, I grieve for the father, we all do. But the cynical exploitation of the victims of U.S. military policy, unfortunately, has become a ritual at presidential addresses to Congress. And instead of praising it, commentators, especially, you know, people who are on the progressive side of the ledger, should be calling it out for what it is, which is fetishization of military sacrifice instead of respecting military sacrifice and human loss.
So the other, and of course, we don't really hear about too much about the contradiction that Trump made in promising the greatest increase to military spending, ever, and then turning around and saying, but there's too much war and that the U.S. is going to, you know, pull back. I mean, is this consistent to offer a vision of an isolationist country militarily, which of course is a good thing, and then boosting the military by this much?
Well, look, this is a guy who, again, this is where underneath all the fireworks and colorful stuff, this is a guy who in many ways is a boilerplate Republican. Republicans always want to increase the military budget, and they always claim they want to reduce the number of wars. The Democrats historically have also increased it, but at a slower rate, which Republicans turn around and will call a cut. So, look, this is just, again, underneath all the showiness, this is just standard Republican stuff. And let's not forget the military-industrial complex, which is now the military-industrial national security complex, still has huge power in Washington, D.C. And to the extent that Trump strayed from the party line at all, I think they've brought him in line.
Okay, so let's talk about what was not brought up, which is Social Security and Medicare. The Republicans have for years said that they want to take aim at those cuts, renaming them entitlements rather than, you know, a tax-funded initiative, which is what it is. And even Democrats had been willing to concede to some modest cuts. But Trump, perhaps knowing that his base heavily relies on these government social safety net programs, seems to be not wanting to address it. What do you think is going on there?
Well, Trump, of course, stood out in for most of the Republican primary as the only Republican. Mike Huckabee was a minor character, but essentially the only Republican candidate who said, I will not cut Social Security or Medicare. It was critical to his winning the nomination. It was critical to his winning the election. He repeated it once he became president. And by the way, those of us who worked in that policy area call them earned benefits because we earn them through our own contributions.
That is a really good framing for it.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden his people have been working, meaning the Republicans, they're getting him to heel on this one too, because all of a sudden in the last couple of days, his people say, well, there won't be cuts in the budget he brings out, but they're not going to rule it out. So I expect a kind of ritual coming up pretty soon where he regretfully compromises on the issue. It was telling to me that he didn't say anything about Social Security or Medicare last night. What it was telling me is that the Republican operatives are bringing him in line and he's going along with it. And I'm worried about my Social Security and my Medicare and yours.
Right. Bernie Sanders gave a video response to the Trump speech. And it seems as though that should have been the speech given by a Democrat. If Democrats have any chance of actually becoming a real opposition party and not dying in obsolescence, why is this party so unwilling to take its place as a real opposition party, picking Thomas Perez to head the DNC rather than Keith Ellison, et cetera?
Well, I think it was Disraeli who said in the gender bias language of his time that you cannot teach a man something if it's in his self-interest not to learn it. I suspect that that has a lot to do with it. And I suspect that the desire to keep the corporate donations flowing has a lot to do with it, although Bernie's campaign showed $228 million raised in small donations, no corporate donors, no billionaire donors. It can be done, but I don't think they want to do the hard work. I think that's why they rejected Keith Ellison, because Keith's approach was, let's get a lot of people to contribute a lot of money, and that becomes part of your grassroots organizing for activism and votes and everything else. That's not the vision the Democratic Party has, and I don't think they want to change their stripes economically either, because remember, a lot of these guys go on from their political lives to very nice jobs at hedge funds and on the boards of large corporations and stuff. You don't want to spoil that by being too lefty. So we need new Democrats if the Democrats are going to be a real opposition party.
Right. I mean, and that's such an important aspect of the critique, which we don't hear much about. And of course, Republicans do the same thing, which is why Trump, after saying he was going to drain the swamp, only then filled it. And it's now overflowing with lobbyists and corporate interests, corporate CEOs with zero government experience. Finally, I want to ask you if you think that in many ways, Trump saw what Sanders had traction with among the American public and used the same sort of rhetoric with a right-wing stamp on it to gain traction and to win power. You write in a piece that you just published critiquing the speech that Trump gave, that he offered a nation of miracles. So he knows how to speak in these grand visionary terms that the Democrats fail at so badly. Will his base hold him accountable for this, you know, for these grand promises that he's making? And in some ways, his promises are even grander than Sanders's.
Well, you know, yeah, I don't think Bernie ever promised a nation of miracles. But look, you know, it's first of all, yes, he absolutely, I wish you could copyright political rhetoric because he stole so much of it from Bernie, from the game is rigged to, you know, the $1 trillion in infrastructure to a million things he said that came from Bernie. The tone came from Bernie. As far as what will his base hold him accountable, you know, it's pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? You know, I mean, the question is, can he keep up the flim-flam and the scamming for 4 years and without a smart opposition party to hold him accountable, he may be able to do just that. The question is, will somebody come up and hold him accountable?
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Richard, for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article on our website. What's the best place to read your works in general?
Oh, probably ourfuture.org, O-R-G, or thisisthezerohour.com for the radio broadcast.
And we'll put those links up on our site. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you.
My guest is Richard Eskow. He is the host of the Zero Hour weekly radio program. He's also a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and we're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/RUwithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Americans have descended into a mass collective trauma over the past several months since the election. Many of us cannot believe that a man such as Donald Trump now occupies the White House, and the barrage of assaults on constitutional protections, minority rights, immigrants and refugees have left us struggling to respond fast enough. The rise of anti-Semitism and white nationalist hate groups coinciding with Trump's tenure has also provoked a fear of fascism in the U.S. While it seems far-fetched to imagine a dictatorial era emerging out of Trump, it can be a useful exercise to examine history and learn in particular from what emerged in Germany before World War II. My guest is Sir Richard J. Evans. He is a preeminent historian, the author of The Coming of the Third Reich in Power, and The Third Reich at War, which are now available as paperbacks from Penguin Press. His newest book is The Pursuit of Power, Europe, 1815 to 1914. He is a Regius Professor Emeritus of History at Cambridge University, President of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and Provost of Gresham College, London. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how have you viewed the rise of Trump from across the Atlantic, given that just a few months before, your country experienced the trauma of Brexit that many people have compared to what has transpired in the United States?
Yeah, there's clearly a mood in the democracies, particularly among people who feel that they have been hammered by globalization, that they're victims of globalization, that their lifestyle, that their has been marginalized, that they have not gained economically over the last 20 years or so, that they've been ignored by political elites. And what we're seeing, I think, both in my country, the UK, and the USA, is a revolt of groups who feel that they've been deprived in this way.
So at the heart of it, of course, is the economic struggles of ordinary people. And it's always easy for politicians to whip up resentment against minority groups as scapegoats. They are the ones taking away your jobs. Looking back at history, was this the kind of rhetoric that we saw in Germany aimed at Jews?
Well, there's similarities and differences. I mean, it's very interesting that, yes, this rhetoric was aimed at Jews in the 1920s. But remember, in Germany, the Jews were less than 1% of the population. It's a really tiny minority. Other minorities were targeted, but in a different way. So the Jews were seen as a kind of world conspiracy to destroy Germany and blamed for Germany's loss in the First World War. And I think there are big differences here. So the whole of the 1920s and the 1930s were in the shadow of the First World War. Germany lost. The Italians felt that they'd lost. Russian Empire had been effectively destroyed. Revolution had taken over with Lenin, the Bolsheviks. And above all, it's a time of a brutalization of politics, of mass movements of uniformed armed stormtroopers on the streets of Germany and Italy in particular, and other countries like Austria and so on. It's a time when the politics is militarized, and violence played an enormous part in the downfall of the Weimar Republic. People in Germany blamed the democracy that had come to power at the end of the First World War for all their ills. The massive depression in the early 1930s, with over a third of the workforce unemployed, far greater than anything you can see today. And that kind of violence, I think, is no longer acceptable. We know that it led to World War, to genocide, to the Holocaust. And you don't see politicians now anywhere really putting hundreds of thousands of armed men onto the streets to beat up and kill their opponents.
However, there was a report that emerged out of the White House that was verified but then denied by the White House that Trump was considering mobilizing the U.S. National Guard to deport immigrants. It might have been a sort of trial balloon for the administration to see how it would be received by the public. And when it was met with outrage, they might have scuttled it.
Yeah.
What about this demonization of Islam and Muslim people as an analogy towards what Jews have faced, keeping in mind that today in the United States, Jews are also being targeted. We're seeing rising anti-Semitism, but Muslims in particular, which Trump openly targets, you know, in using the term radical Islamic terrorism, this is a phenomenon that has actually impacted startlingly few people directly in the United States. But Trump manages to scare Americans.
That's right. Yes. I mean, I to come to the first, back to the first point for a moment, I think anyone who wants to establish some kind of authoritarian regime now has to use the state. They have to use the army, the police, National Guard, if you like, and that, or its equivalents. So there's a rather a different situation. They have to use the armed and military arm of the state. As for scapegoating and targeting, yes, I think there is a worrying similarity, at least in the rhetoric that's used by some of President Trump's team about radical jihadist Islamists pointing a dagger at the heart of America and intending to destroy the whole of American civilization. That's quite similar to what the Nazis said about the Jews. Of course, you have to remember that it's not until the World War from 1939 in Europe, I know the Americans entered in 1941, to 1945, that the Nazis then, under the conditions of war, move over to mass murder. But there were certainly many attacks on Jews in Germany and Austria before 1939. There were no extermination camps, that came later. And there was a climate of both of fear of this supposed Jewish conspiracy against Germany and of aggression towards Jews, who, of course, bore no, I mean, there wasn't a conspiracy, they bore no responsibility. It's all most Jews in Germany, as I said, a tiny minority, were liberal or conservative. They were not radical revolutionaries. They were not interested in destroying the German state. They wanted to live in it and prosper like everyone else. Hmm. So it is worrying that there have been anti-Semitic attacks in both in rhetoric against cemeteries, and it's very heartening to see that some Muslim organizations in the United States are helping with the restoration of Jewish cemeteries. I think in any minority groups who are targeted in this way have to come together to defend themselves.
Right. And it took Trump several days to actually even denounce anti-Semitism. The first few times he was asked about it, he simply got defensive, which was frightening. Now, what about the relationship between Trump and the Republican Party? What historical lessons are there, say, for the relationship between Hitler and the German National People's Party? There's the sense that the Republican Party is going to control Trump, that they're going to bring him to heel, that they're going to kind of tame some of his most unpredictable and kind of radical notions. Was there a similar sense in Germany?
Yeah, okay. I just, on the issue of anti-Semitism, of course, it's very worrying that the White House did not make any mention of the Jews on Holocaust Memorial Day.
Yes.
And when pressed upon this, that they said they wanted to be inclusive. But it's very important to remember that the Jews in Nazi Germany were targeted as existential threats to German existence, complete paranoid conspiracy theory. But that's, they were targeted especially. So Nazi policy during the war was to, before the war, was to get as many Jews out of Germany as possible, to deport them. During the war, it was to kill all the Jews wherever they could be found, because all of them were seen to be this existential threat. And mass murder of Slavs. I mean, over 3 million Russian prisoners of war were killed by the Nazis. It's often forgotten, but that was to get them out of the way. It wasn't because they were seen as an existential threat. So there's a difference, and that's why Holocaust Memorial Day, while we remember all the other victims of Nazism, homosexuals, Gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, even Slavs, so-called, it's important to realize that the Jews were different, and there's a higher level of hatred and fear. So that's a very important point. Now, coming back to the next question you asked.
Yes.
The Nazis got 37% of the vote in Germany in 1932, the highest percentage, and they were unable to, as it were, improve on that. That's as much. That's a very respectable. I mean, many governments in democratic countries come into power with 37% of the vote. They were put into power when they lost votes in the November elections of 1932. They were seen as being weak, and so there's a conservative nationalist party that went into coalition. Hitler was the chancellor, the head of the government, in January 1933, but the nationalists, as you said, the DNVP, the Nationalist Party, were in coalition with them and hoped to control Hitler. They thought, a lot of people thought, he'll calm down after he comes into government. And in any case, there's a majority of these conservatives in the government, and they thought they'd be able to control him. Now, their weakness, and this is a really important difference, I think, their weakness was they had almost no electoral support. Almost all of their voters had deserted to the Nazis. They only had a small number of votes. In March 1933, there were fresh elections were held. That's part of the deal to appoint Hitler as chancellor, as head of the government. And even on conditions where it was very difficult because of intimidation, bullying, threats, and so on, for the opposition parties to campaign, still, the Nazis only got 44% of the vote. And the other 8% were the nationalists. 44%, 8%. You can see the nationalists are in a really weak position, quite unlike the Republicans today, who are in a very strong position in both houses of Congress.
Right.
So they were unable in 1933 to control Hitler. He was able to use mass violence on the streets, which again is something we haven't seen in the United States, and able to use the fact that he had this mass electorate behind him, which the nationalists, the conservatives, did not have.
Are there similarities that we can draw between the rhetoric that Trump has expressed and Hitler's rhetoric? This America first, make America great again, these simplistic slogans that he really has been able to use effectively to kind of, you know, get his to broaden his base.
Yeah, absolutely. Almost the only interesting part of Hitler's notorious autobiographical tract, Mein Kampf, My Struggle, is where he talks about propaganda. He talks about how to win over the masses. And he says you've got to have simple slogans and repeat them endlessly. They didn't really mean very much, so his slogan didn't necessarily have any policy implications, but you do that. And there is a sort of similarity there. On the other hand, Trump kind of shoots from the hip, like in one of the old Westerns. You know, he doesn't think before he speaks. His speech last night's different. It's clearly carefully prepared. But normally, you know, he tweets away in the early hours of the morning without really thinking about what he's going to say. Everything Hitler did was very carefully prepared. All his speeches were thought out in advance. Sometimes he rehearsed them before he actually went on to give them. I think that's a big difference. There's nothing really spontaneous there about what Hitler said, despite the appearance of being spontaneous.
Now, we don't just remember Hitler, but we remember Goebbels. We remember his right-hand men, if you will. Trump has surrounded himself by Stephen Miller, by Steve Bannon, by some of these dangerous figures whose rhetoric, you know, is a little bit more extreme than Trump's. Does that also offer a clue as to the kind of leader Trump is, where he takes advice from a small, tightly woven group, a cabal of both sort of men who might serve as yes men, but then also kind of steer him in a direction because he's easily manipulated?
Yeah, there's certainly similarities there. So Hitler did exactly the same. He surrounded himself with advisors whose power came from the fact they were close to him, not from the offices that they held. And in fact, although they were government ministers and he appointed one after another to the cabinet until they outnumbered the conservatives and forced them out, but these men like Goebbels, Goering, Robert Ley, Himmler eventually, their power came because it came to them because they were close to Hitler. And in fact, the cabinet, once Hitler had got the parliament by a mixture of intimidation, threats, and various offers to agree by a two-thirds majority that the cabinet alone could make laws, didn't need the parliament anymore, didn't need the president as a figurehead in Germany in the 30s, but still they could make it. Then the cabinet more or less fell into disuse, and it was just Hitler and his friends. The cabinet wasn't beating at all by 1939. It just sort of withered away and atrophied. So I think there's a kind of similarity there about these surrounding yourself with people, not because they hold a constitutional office, but because they're close to you. But I think it's a difference as well. And that is, there's never any doubt in Nazi Germany that's Hitler who wrote the scenarios, who set the pace, who set the tone. He is the one in charge. He's driving all the rest of them. I think the Trump and his advisors, it's rather different. It's because sometimes it's rather difficult to see, and President Trump being consistent about things, and it's difficult to discern any kind of overall policy thrust. And you get the sense that his advisors have much more power and much more influence over him than, say, Hitler's did over him.
Well, we only have a few weeks to examine of Trump as president. We're going to have you back on maybe in a few months or a year. Let's turn to Trump's attitude towards the courts, the judiciary in the United States. Very early, he showed a lack of understanding of the role of the judiciary in the American system of government, and you know, referred to judges who struck down his executive orders as so-called judges. Even during his campaign, he showed disdain for judges. Does that have any echoes in Hitler's relationship towards the court system in Germany?
Well, there are differences. So, I mean, of course, in the United States, the Constitution has these three pillars of the Constitution are meant to counterbalance each other, the legislature, the presidency, and the courts. The courts are very robust in the United States. And I think they're in a very important means of defending democracy, human rights, and so on. Whereas in Nazi Germany, I think the courts were much more sympathetic to start with the Nazis. Most judges had been appointed under the Kaiser before the First World War. They hated the Weimar Republic. They were very conservative. They welcomed the Nazis coming to power insofar as they promised a kind of return to order, bringing the death penalty back, which had more or less gone in the Weimar Republic, and so on. However, they did have a respect for the law. It's interesting that in the first months of 1933, when the Nazi stormtroopers were running riot all over Germany, arresting, imprisoning in concentration camps, communists and socialists who were opponents of the Nazis, there were a lot of prosecutions, thousands of prosecutions of stormtroopers for acts of violence and acts of mayhem and breaking the law and so on. These are eventually quashed by Hitler. But the Supreme Court in Nazi Germany, the Reich Court, was set to by the Nazis to try the alleged perpetrators of the Reichstag fire. Now, to explain, in the end of February 1933, the National Parliament was burned down. It seems, although there's argument about it, it seems that this is burnt down by a lone, somewhat deranged Dutch anarchist. And then he was put on trial by the Nazis with a lot of communist leaders who the Nazis blamed in a conspiracy theory. And that was a justification of their taking over emergency powers. Now, the court dismissed all the charges against everyone apart from this Dutchman. They didn't do the Nazis' bidding. And what Hitler then did was to set up a parallel system of courts, which he could control, so-called People's Court at the head, and then the special court. So the courts did actually show some resistance to Hitler's rule.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, the Reichstag fire, as it's called. And a lot of people are worried about that sort of thing happening here in the United States. We saw on September 11th, 2001, how a horrific terrorist attack opened the door for wars that continue today, for this system of war, for the emergence of the Department of Homeland Security, for all sorts of emergency powers. And Trump has tweeted, in response to a judge striking down his Muslim travel ban, he tweeted, "Just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system." And so in response to that, Americans are worried that tomorrow, if there is a horrific terrorist attack in the U.S., Trump has already warned us that it's going to be the judge's fault. That's really frightening.
Yeah, it is quite alarming. And I think it's very important to beware of a state government taking emergency powers. This was built into the Constitution of the Weimar Republic, which still operated in the Third Reich in Hitler's time. And it provided for the president to declare emergency powers. And that meant the suspension of civil liberties, the right to arrest opponents of the regime, tapping of telephones, suppression of freedom of the press, and all of that was achieved by an emergency decree on the morning after the legislature of the Reichstag burnt down, on the pretext that it was a communist who burned it down. And that was a reason why, of course, Hitler was so angry with the Supreme Court for saying, no, it wasn't there. You can't prove it was the communists. And that Reichstag fire decree, as it's called, that suspension of civil liberties effectively, the suspension of the Constitution, was renewed, just renewed and renewed and renewed right up to 1945, to the end of the regime. And that's a taking of emergency powers, I think, is a key step towards the establishment of a dictatorship. And of course, it's very easy to find a justification for that. In fact, the burning down of the Reichstag did not mean there was a communist attempt at revolution. It's completely made up by the Nazis.
And Trump has already, of course, attempted to use the killings of Americans by a handful of undocumented immigrants as justification for building the wall in the U.S. Between the U.S. and Mexico. If something more dramatic were to happen, it's really quite frightening to imagine what he would do with that. Now, what about the role of rather Trump's relationship with and attitude towards the media, the U.S. media? I don't think has ever been in this position in recent memory as it is today, being labeled the enemy of the American people by Trump. Is there any lesson that we can learn from Hitler's relationship to the German media that might illustrate what's happening here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's similar, incidentally, to some newspapers in this country, in the United Kingdom, which condemned judges who ruled that Parliament had to approve the law taking Britain out of the European Union, label those judges as enemies of the people. That's a phrase you find. Yeah. It's a very alarming phrase, and one that was used by the Nazis before the and during the Second World War. Certainly, the propaganda chief of the Nazis and then propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, launched furious vitriolic attacks on the German press, what he called the lying Jewish press. In due course, during the Nazi seizure of power in the first months of 1933, newspapers were closed down or they were forced to print only Nazi news. The media were brought under control. Editors were fired. The Nazi publishing empire was built up so it could buy up oppositional newspapers. And the free press is very important for a healthy democratic society, and that's precisely, of course, because it can criticize the government. And if you don't criticize, if you don't have a free press that exposes corruption, for example, in the government, then you get a massive growth of corruption, as in the Nazi period. It was what some people have called a kleptocracy. In other words, the leading Nazis helped themselves to as much money and property as they could, and they were all millionaires by the time the Second World War broke out.
Now, Trump has had a very interesting relationship with the military and intelligence agencies here in the United States. Usually one needs, or, you know, when we think of sort of dictatorial regimes, the military really is needed to side with any dictator in order to maintain power. But Trump's relationship with the military is mixed. I mean, he's promised to boost the military budget, but many in the military are sort of convinced that he doesn't understand much about how the U.S. has waged its wars. The intelligence community seems very strongly opposed to him. How did Hitler have, what sort of relationship did Hitler have with the German military? I mean, I think that's a pretty obvious question given the rise of Nazi Germany, but it seems as though there was much less contention there between those two institutions.
Yeah, well, that's because with the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I when Germany was defeated, that's because the treaty imposed a limit of 100,000 men on the size of the German army. It banned the building or use of any combat aircraft or combat ships. It had a lot of provisions that really restricted German military power. So it was quite easy for Hitler to offer the German military getting back to their old status, taking the lid off the Treaty of Versailles limits on the military power, building battleships, building combat aircraft, all the rest of it. That was very easy to win over the military. But also, there was a clear purpose to this. So you have to ask in any society, what's the military for? Why do we need it? It's very important because for that, you then judge how whether or not we need a large military or a small one. Or do we have, let's say, more battleships or more aircraft carriers or more troops or more planes and so on. And in the case of Nazi Germany, the aim was very clearly understood by everybody from the start. And that is conquering and winning back the territories that were taken away from Germany in the west, the northwest, and particularly in the east in Poland, by the Treaty of Versailles. And then military were promised that when they'd reached full strength, they would be able to launch a war of conquest on Eastern Europe and get back what they lost in the First World War and make Germany the dominant power in Europe by force of arms. So everyone is very clear about what's going to happen. I think there's a real lack of clarity in discussions of about the military and about intelligence and so on in the United States at the moment. It's very unclear why. What's the point of having more troops, more weapons, more guns, spending more on the military?
I'm speaking with Sir Richard J. Evans, a preeminent historian of Nazi Germany. He's the author of The Coming of the Third Reich in Power, and The Third Reich at War, among other books. He's Regius Professor Emeritus of History at Cambridge University, president of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and provost of Gresham College, London. We're going to keep Richard on for an extended conversation, which you can get on the premium content section of our website, which is risingupwithsonali.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/RUwithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RUwithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUwithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. We've got Hard Knock Radio coming right up for you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, taking place Thursdays through Sundays until March 4th at PCC Cascade in Portland. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a Vision of Africa package for Western viewers. The films celebrate Africa's achievements, expose its failures, and reveal possibilities for a hopeful future. The festival includes live music performances, plays and short films, documentary, and a Women's Filmmakers Week. Again, that's the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday through Sundays until March 4th, at Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at Portland Community College, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information and specific times for the screenings can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.